Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here. Thank you all so much for giving to our Patreon. Without you, we're nothing. So thank you. Today's guest, I am honored to have with me the author of Decoding Madness, a forensic psychologist explores the criminal mind, Richard Letary. Thank you so much for being on the show, man.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So it is safe to say that psychology is in its heyday. Do you think that's true? It feels to me like people are more interested in the human mind than ever before, especially when it comes to psychopathy.
It does seem that way. I think people are interested in true crime. I mean, there's just so many blogs, so many shows about it, even on Netflix, documentaries.
They're totally mainstream.
Yeah, it's, and you know, just that might have always been the case. I remember even as a kid, Perry Mason, all these shows. There's just so many more venues now, and the art is just so much more so gratifying to watch. Yeah. It's so creative. So, but I think there is a tremendous interest in it.
I think so too, and I hope it has a positive ending when it comes to us all trying to figure out what this jelly is in between our ears and how to control it so that we can live our best lives. When it comes to the mind of someone who is psychotic, can you talk a little bit about some of the differences? What makes somebody go to that? Or what? How does this become? Is it nature? Is it nurture? When it comes to somebody who is truly psychotic in the minds of experts?
Well, you know, again, psychosis is a particular form of major mental illness. It's a little different from what we from a psychopath. Someone who is psychotic has an illness like schizophrenia, for example, where they hallucinate, where they're delusional. They may think people are after you. I've done many evaluations of people with major mental illness like that, schizophrenia. And evaluated whether they were insane at the time, meaning that they were so ill that they didn't know what they were doing. For example, one of my first cases, in the book, I evaluated this young man who stabbed his mother, but he believed that the world would come to an end and he'd be burning up with the sun coming down from the sky if he didn't do it. He believed his mother was the cause of this.
Right.
So that, and he had years of history of this kind of a serious mental illness. So he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, but it's very different from someone who's a psychopath. A psychopath is somebody who has no morals, no conscience. So they have no connection to other people. They're very self-centered and narcissistic, and they just want to gratify themselves, and they'll use other people as instruments for their purpose.
Right.
So those are the real extreme kinds of criminal types that some of the famous ones.
Well, I'm reminded just quickly here, John Hinckley Jr., he's now out of prison and he's on Twitter. And he's a country singer now. But when it comes to this man shooting, obviously, then President Reagan, the fact that he got off, or not off, but the fact he was found not guilty for reasons of insanity, obviously spent many years in a psychiatric ward, it doesn't seem like we really, I don't think that would happen today. If somebody would take a shot at a president, I feel like it would be a difficult case to get them off based upon reasons of insanity, although you could argue, based upon what we've seen in recent years, the world's more insane than ever before. But why did somebody like a John Hinckley Jr., like, can you kind of maybe just, let's talk about him, and I'm not sure if you have any insight, but just sort of the macro. When it comes to somebody like that, how would you look at what they did, and how do you say, well, yes, they did this, yes, they pre-planned this, but it's not really their fault because of a mental condition?
Well, I have to tell you that after Hinckley was found not guilty by reason of insanity, there was you're probably too young to remember this.
I'm 40.
You're 40. Okay. So that was like, so you were a little boy when that happened, right? Yeah. So I was too, but not that little. So, but I vividly recall what happened. There was a real social outcry to the extent that a lot of the laws were changed on what constitutes insanity.
Right.
The laws were somewhat more flexible than they are now. For example, in California, the law was changed to what's referred to now as the McNaughton standard. But that I have to use when I evaluate whether someone is insane or not. What that means is that it's called a two-pronged cognitive test. I'll explain that.
Please.
The two prongs are, first of all, the person has to have a major mental illness. Like they have to have a major disease of the mind, such like, so that they, and that's one prong. And that has to be active at the time of when they committed the crime. So they can't have a history of schizophrenia. That doesn't count. The evidence has to prove that they were actively psychotic at the time.
And that's let's pretend element. That the world's completely off its rocker and I'm a judge. How do you tell me or convince me that this person was going through a psychiatric fit? Okay. How do you verbalize that?
It's a long and difficult evaluation because it's not just like a clinical encounter where I just talk to the patient. I get the records, police records. I get videotapes of what, if there's any videotape of what happened at the time, the videotape of the interview that occurred immediately after it happened, if that's possible, if he gets arrested quickly,
right.
His statements about it, family member statements, hospital records, so that you have to look at the totality of it or what he tells me at the time, right. In my evaluations of him.
And so, then how do you also, I'm sorry, we'll go on to point two in a second, but I've spoken to some experts and we talked about, the deception of mental illness. You know, you have like Nicholas Cruz, for example, who was just pled guilty for murdering all the people in Parkland. The John Holmes, the man who shot up the Colorado movie theater, pretending to be, you know, air quotes, crazy. How do you, in your mind, are there just a few like easy, not easy per se, but are there just a few things that you look at where like, that person's faking it, that person's batshit? I'm sure you don't use the verbiage batshit, but hey. I'm a layman.
In a batshit syndrome.
Yeah.
But no, it's takes a lot. It's not just a few questions, observations, but I do extensive psychological testing to rule out, to see if a person is what's called, the technical term is malingering, air quotes. In other words, that they're exaggerating their symptoms for personal gain, whether it's financial or in this case. So I have some ingenious tests to test for memory. If they're faking, I don't really get this. A lot of times people commit crimes and they say, I was blacked out. I can test for memory. And it tests if they're being truthful about their memory.
And not trick question per se, but what kind of questions expose if they were being deceptive about their memory? How do you, is it a series of questions where they get the one wrong and you're like, gotcha, like Perry Mason?
No, it's a series and it's not just one test. I'll do, before I come to the conclusion that somebody is malingering, because that's a serious allegation, someone who could be ill, and you're saying they're not.
Right.
I do multiple tests and I have to really be solid in my opinion, not just they said something, I got you. It's not like that at all. So for example, I'll give you one example of a memory test.
Okay.
And I do several memory tests, but this one's kind of makes sense, I think. I show them 50 cards of familiar objects, chairs, that kind of thing. And I ask them to look at it, and I tell them it's a memory test. So the test is somewhat deceptive. I tell them it's a memory test, but it's not. It's to test whether they're being accurate, whether they're being honest. So each of these cards, a stove, a chair, and I show it to them for 5 seconds or so. So, and I have 50 of them, and then I do it again, show them again, 50 of them. So, and then I say, okay, now I'm going to show you a card that has two pictures on it. One with one of the pictures you saw, and one that's not with one. Okay. So I'm testing your memory. Which one did you? Which, so I do 50 of those, where he has to look at, and there's on those 50 cards, there's a 50 cards he looked, 50 images he looked at, and an image he did not look at.
Yeah.
So then I ask him to tell me which one is it. Now his score on that is very revealing because he doesn't know this, and now listeners of to your podcast will know.
Yeah.
Even if you're extremely developmentally disabled, pictures of common objects are recalled by everybody, even someone with a terrible memory, someone with brain damage.
Sure.
So they recall a certain number. I won't disclose them, at least a certain number. So if I get someone like that and they tell me, I have no memory of what I did, you know, I can't remember. I don't think I did it. And this is one test I did.
Yeah, yeah.
If they did not meet the threshold for what they should have, then I'm very suspicious about their memory.
Interesting. So they'll purposely throw the test.
Because it may seem like it's a valid memory test because you're given lots of photos to look at.
Yeah.
And you think, well, nobody's going to remember those. And so I can fake that. But that's not true. These common objects, there's a whole body of research to show even people with severe memory problems remember a certain number of those.
So like Michael Myers would pass this in a heartbeat. You'd be like, that's a chair, dude. I know it's a chair.
Almost anyone who's trying could pass this.
Right.
Almost any people with learning disabilities, people with brain damage, people with developmental disabilities do pass a certain threshold.
Right.
That they remember a significant number of these pictures. So I'm just giving you one example of a multitude of tests that are given.
This doesn't have to be psychologists revealed. We don't have to reveal, the greatest magic secrets. But that is really fascinating.
But that is. So I wanted to give an example of that because it's makes clear on how the testing is very robust. And it's very scientific. It's very empirical.
Yeah.
And there are a number of other tests that have been validated, and I have. Because I have to testify on this and I'll be cross-examined. Why? What does that count for? How do we know that's true? So there's a whole body of research. These tests take years and years to develop and then are validated with thousands of studies. So right. I can compare scores with someone who's developmentally disabled, someone who has true memory problems. I'll do an IQ test. So I'll know his IQ. People with this level of IQ should at least be doing a certain the level of performance.
Sure.
So we do all that. So you rule in or you rule out. Let's say, for example, I did this with Hinckley and he was not faking it. Then from my evaluation of him, his symptoms that he shows me, psychological tests I give him that have validity scales on it, I can judge that his symptoms are credible. And it's consistent with his history. He's got four, I get his records. He has multiple psychiatric hospitalizations where he has the same symptoms 5 years ago, 10 years ago that he has now. So this is not faking it. This is someone who has serious mental illness. Now the question is, were those symptoms active at the time of the crime? Because he's mentally ill doesn't mean you don't get a pass on that.
So the first prong is
a mental illness.
Mental illness. And now the second one is to find out if they were going through that at the time of the crime.
No. That's the first. The first is a mental
illness. This is all the first.
The time of the crime. The second prong is, did the mental illness interfere with their ability to know what they did was wrong, morally or legally? So because they have a mental illness, like one of the individuals I evaluated in my book, he had a severe mental illness. He believed his family was cloned. He had what kind of Capgras syndrome. In other words, he was sort of like body snatchers. The title of the chapter is Case of the Body Snatchers. He thought his family's body was snatched up and there was someone else in there. And there was evidence for that. But at the time when he killed, he was angry. It wasn't his mental illness that caused him to kill. Now, he had less control of himself because he's such an ill guy, but I couldn't conclude he was insane because he did the act out of anger, in my opinion. And this was from multiple evaluations of him, multiple hours with him, meetings with the family, psychological testing records.
So my question then is, so if at the time he's not going through a mental fit, but then so he's, you know, tried and charged and found guilty and according to the court sane, but then he gets incarcerated and these go unchecked, the mental illness continues. So then what happens to him? Like, is there any concern about what happens then when somebody who may have not been in the throes of a mental illness goes into prison, but they're still mentally ill?
Right.
I mean, it can lead to chaos.
Right. Someone like that would be, well, he would be likely, if he weren't found mentally was found insane. He probably still did his mitigation because he is ill. So he maybe he couldn't actually have the same kind of control over himself that you did. So, okay. So instead of being found first degree murder, he'd be found second degree murder. But your question is still real appropriate. What happens to someone like that when they go to prison? Well, hopefully they go to a prison system that's humane and they're given mental health treatment. I worked at a prison for a while years ago in California here, and there was a whole section that I worked on. It was for inmates that were mentally ill. They were separated from the regular prisoners because of their severe mental illness. Because if they're not, they'd be vulnerable in there to psychopaths.
Well, it sounds like, I think that you would refer to it as anarchy, right? I mean, the U.S. prison system, just reading a little bit of some of your thoughts, talking about the U.S. prison system and how, chaotic and how non-serving it can be for the people who are the most mentally ill. Have you seen any progress in that when it comes to our system? Because obviously, with all of the facilities being shut down in the 80s, we're still scratching tooth and nail to get any kind of funding for anyone who might be in need of psychiatric help. And how are we doing as a country right now when it comes to dealing with this? Because
yeah, I think tragically, they're doing terribly. It's not the sole cause of homelessness, but it's a significant problem, the homelessness, the mentally ill, because like you say, in the 80s, the major state institutions were closed down, and for good reasons. They were, a lot of them were shabby, but there was never funding for community mental health. So right. Over time, you've seen a degradation in mental health care. Even in private hospitals these days, the serious mental ill gets short shrift. They get hospitalized when they have an acute psychotic breakdown, but they're in for 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. As soon as they're not actively psychotic, they're let out of the hospital. So many of the men that I've evaluated who've done things like murder their mother or stabbed a roommate had recently been released from the hospital. They were right. In the hospital. In fact, one of the cases, this is one of the cases in my book, this guy left the hospital, the defendant, and the family was pleading with the hospital, said, don't let him out. He says he's better, but he's not. We know him. Right. They pleaded so much, the psychiatrist got annoyed with the mother and said, you need help. A week later, he killed his brother.
Oh my! So, is there any accountability on that then? Again, I don't want to go down the doctors and all of the red tape that comes with the law or with being sued and all that stuff.
Yeah, it was horrible. It's horrible, and this is not. I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon because people leave the hospital so quickly. So there's just not the funding for adequate care.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate. When it comes to, we do a show called Last Podcast on the Left. We talk a lot about serial killers, and it seems like it's an ever moving conversation when it comes to what leads to making a serial killer. We talked a lot about the McDonald's triad, nurture, nature, forms of abuse, hitting your head. But now it seems as if there's some information that the McDonald's triad might not be the best way to indicate if somebody is going to grow to be a psychopath. Is there any, what should people look at as indicators or as reasons why somebody goes and, whether it be shoots up a school or back in the day, more of a serial killer, a long run of murders over a series of years. Is there anything?
That's a serial killer, right?
That's a serial killer, not a mass shooter. Let's talk about serial killer. What should we look at now as far as like, okay, there's a lot of red flags here. And because of that, hopefully we can help curb it. And hopefully this person doesn't go down a road of violence.
Well, it's hard to describe or just say what are the red flags for someone to identify a serial killer, because they're relatively rare. We don't have a large database and say these are the characteristics of a serial killer. But actually, I just did a podcast on this It was really on psychopathy, but the person was interested in serial killers, specifically the one in Las Vegas that happened a few years ago. But
Stephen Paddock, the mass shooter?
Was that Stephen?
The man who shot up
the
mass
shooting. Yeah, that was
disgusting. So unbelievable. But I mean, that's, we can do serial killer and we can talk mass shooters, because I'm interested to hear the differences in your perspective.
I think I can just maybe speak more about the similarity that the mass shooter is one that would happen in a fit of rage, where the serial killer is even worse. It's more pernicious because it's so premeditated and planned over time, and they're so sneaky about it and unpredictable, and they're going around the nation covering it up and doing it in a systematic way to cover it up. But those individuals are likely very psychopathic in nature. When I would say a psychopath, then again, that's different from somebody who's psychotic. A psychopath may be psychotic, but usually they're not. They're rational, but they have no morals. They have, and there's a there's both a nature and nurture element to this. The nature element is that they have an underactive emotional system in the brain, the limbic system, so that things don't bother them. And you see this even when they were younger. It's hard to discipline because nothing bothers them.
Right.
And they don't have any attachments to people. They don't form attachments naturally. So they could do what they want. And without attachments, when you feel you can do what you want because nothing bothers you, you don't respond to punishment.
It's almost freeing, it sounds like, for a second. It must be like, wow, I have a superpower. I don't care what people think.
Yeah, you don't care. You're exactly right. That can be feel very powerful because you can do things other people don't do.
Right.
You know, and then you can manipulate others. You don't mind bullying people. If somebody's hurt or crying, it's the same as watching TV to you. It doesn't bother you. It
doesn't matter. Yeah.
So with that, that also interferes with your bonding over time. So your empathy for others, you don't have feelings for others.
Can you work on that? The brain being a muscle, can you, with the nature aspect of it, if you are born, the son of a CEO and you're maybe not exactly the most emotionally connected person, can nurture help that kind of nature and bring it together?
Yes. Yes, you're not born a serial killer. You may be born with a certain brain structure,
right,
that we talked about. But let's say you are, and you're raised in a family that's very attuned to this and saying, this kid needs limits. This kid, so you punish when they do something bad. He goes and he bullies, you punish them. But at the same time, you don't beat them.
Right.
Nurture them. There's a feeling you both nurture. Well, you know, there's a term used by family therapists, what you have to do. You have to sort of kick in the ass, but a pat on the back at the same time. You have to be able to do that. If you're a sophisticated parent enough, emotional, I don't mean intellectual. I mean, you have to be a college professor. But if you're emotionally, I shouldn't say physical, you're emotionally mature enough to realize this. Your kid needs this. You do that. That can go a long way. But if you're, if you're a CEO and you think he's bullying kids, that's the way the world is. You know, he needs to be that way. That's what gets you places. You can be raising an SOB for a kid. Now, he may not be a serial killer, but he may end up being, what's called a successful psychopath. People in politics, in medicine, in the professions, that really any position where there's power and money, there's going to be somebody who's psychopathically oriented to some measure. You know, and you think about psychopathy too, is on a spectrum. On the far end of it are the serial killers, but there's other less psychopathic, but more with a style like that, that
sure,
could be very destructive. So, or if you have a kid like that and you're raised by two English college professors who just want their kids to be and don't want to discipline them, that's going to be bad.
Right. It's so tough.
So it's the match between family, between caretakers and the basic nature of a growing child that's important. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Do you give credit to the McDonald Triad as far as like injuring animals, brain injuries, wetting the bed? Do you give any credence to that? Because it seems
you watch for it, but it's not what's called pathognomonic, which means it's not causal. Because the problem with some of these things, a lot of people have those characteristics that grow up to be okay. So that's why you need a huge database of people. Why it's hard to say specifically how do you identify serial killers. To do so, you need a large database, because a lot of the characteristics of serial killers, a lot of people have that aren't serial killers.
Of course, most.
You know, so if most people aren't.
Most people who are a little.
Is very unique. It's a very specific, very unique set of people. So it's harder to identify them until after the fact. But people will say, oh, I knew. See, he was a bully when he was a kid. Well, lots of people are bullies when they were kids and grow up to not be serial killers. So you can't use that. He tortured animals. But, you know, that's something I see a lot in these, you know, psychopathic people. But I also see it in some people who were really mistreated when they were young and they took it out and they feel bad about it when they're older. So you can't jump to conclusions. It's too people are too complicated to jump.
You've obviously been at this for a long time. It's a social science. It's amorphous. It's always moving. In recent times, I mean, you know, it's crazy to think about. The smartphone didn't come out until 2007. We have been living most of our lives forever and ever and ever without it. But
without
it's here.
The damn thing.
And now it's here. It's been 15 years or so. How has that impacted human psychopathy? How has that impacted just the human brain in general, being connected to this universe and, you know, that's on our phones? Have you noticed any trends that you think are hyper unique to the mid-aughts
and now? It's too early to tell. There's all kind of conflicting information on that. But, I mean, in terms of what we have found with all the media, the attention span of people is much less. I mean, that's pretty obvious. And the social media sometimes could have a distorting effect on how we see ourselves and how we see others.
What would be a negative ramification of shorter attention span? Would it be that the brain and the synapses just aren't connecting in certain ways that they used to? Or like, what is a negative thing for having, you know, people digest things in 30-second or 15-second clips?
Well, yeah, it's then hard to sustain and work through a complex idea, a complex notion, and to stick with it. And it reduces frustration tolerance. It reduces anxiety management. You want things right away. You're used to things right away.
Right.
You go on Google. Just ask Google. You're not willing to say, okay, this is a complex thing that's beyond something I can get a quick answer to. I have to do some deep diving here. I have to tolerate confusion for a while in the data that I'm looking at, in what I'm reading. And I have to deliberate about it. I have to talk about it.
And do people make people feel like they don't have control if they can't live in a world of confusion and science and just constantly wondering, I love politics and my political views evolve as I receive information. I feel pretty solid in my views, but you always have to be willing to absorb and then be like, oh, okay, my mind has changed. Are we seeing people have a more difficult time being comfortable in the gray?
I think so. I think that's true. I can't give you scientific studies for that, but I mean, just from my personal experience, I think that's true. And the problem is, too, when you have you may or may not have heard the term periphery of ignorance. When you don't have much information and you're just dealing with superficial information, you think you know more than you know, because your periphery of ignorance, the circumference around what you know is small. So that circumference is small. The more you know, you expand your periphery of ignorance.
And the less you know.
The more you realize what you don't know.
Exactly,
So if you're not doing that, there's a whole body of literature on this, social psychologists. It's called the Dunn-Crutcher finding. There's the two social psychologists. They demonstrate that people who are more less knowledgeable about something are more sure in their opinions.
Yeah.
So the more you know,
that's horrifying, isn't it?
To stay open and say, I think I know this, but let me listen to what's going on. But that takes a certain data knowledge base. And if you're only not attending and you can't say, okay, this is a complex thing, let me really delve into this. If you're used to just getting a cursory, looking at Yahoo News in the two paragraphs and think you know everything,
exactly.
And that becomes a style, you know, you're not going to know what you don't know. So that could be a problem.
Decoding Madness, a forensic psychologist explores the criminal mind. Richard Letary is with us. And thank you so much for giving us your time. Maybe just 10 more minutes or so. Is that cool?
Yeah. Okay. That'd be fine.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Check out this book. It's absolutely fascinating. It's like to the world. We're seeing a macro of there's so much mental illness, and now it's being manifested in American politics. It's being manifested in just everyday life. We're seeing constant freakouts, and people are just having, I think, a really difficult time absorbing the new reality. How do we have to live with this shit, right? Like the internet's not going anywhere. I used to have a typewriting professor in high school, a teacher. It was Sister Susan Bundy. And she was like, you never know. Catholic school. She's like, you never know when computers are going out of style. They're just a trend. And it's like, I don't know.
I don't know, sister.
I'm not sure. I think we just spent too much money on typewriters and I have to take this class now. It's not going anywhere. So Where do we go now? What do we do to address the people, you know, these sad people who are going to places like Comet Pizza because they think it's a huge pedophile ring, who are, you know, who believe RFK Jr. is going to come back and be president. I mean, this stuff is real and it's infecting every area of our country. Specifically, we can focus on, well, whatever. We don't have to focus on politics, but you don't understand. So where do we go from here? What do we do? We can pass all the legislation in the world that Facebook needs to monitor their site better. But the genie's out of the container here. And I don't know what. So now how do we guide people and how do we live in this world and live in a functioning society? Because right now it's not.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say, don't overreact too much that it is bad politically right now. And there's all these conspiracy theories. Part of the problem is we're still adjusting, I think, to the new age of multimedia and having access to so much information that people don't have any information.
Exactly.
So they narrow down, they live in their little silos. And that's become problematic, and it's allowed for a lot of manipulation by powers that be, whether it's the Russians or whatever it is.
Anyone who wants to maintain power, yeah.
Yeah, it's people to use power and to manipulate the masses. Now that we're still adjusting to how we're going to deal with that, but I want to say this before we end that. And I go into this in my last chapter. It's much more hopeful. When you look at the span of history, and I don't mean over the last 50 years, I mean over the last 1,000 years.
Yeah.
We are still moving in the right direction. For example, are you familiar with Steven Pinker, his book on Our Better Angels? He goes through this in detail. There's also a anthropologist that I quote in the book, Wingram, I think his name is, talks about this on a biological level, and Pinker talks about it on a psychosocial level, that we are moving in a much more civilized societies over the last 1,000 years, so that there was much less violence in the 20th century than there was in previous centuries.
And we dropped two bombs.
That's hard to believe. Like 60 million people killed in World War II. But when you look at what humans did to each other over the centuries, it is outrageous.
But it's safe to say we can do more damage now than ever before.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, because we have the weaponry.
Exactly.
But I think our civil, that's why the political situation now is so dangerous, because what's helped us to be improved as society is our civil institutions, such that they're stable enough, when they're stable enough in democratic countries, that nobody's above the law.
Right.
That's a really important basic principle.
And let's go to the criminal aspect of it, but sort of tangentially tied. Let's say you go and you commit an act of violence and you committed that act of violence because you have a Facebook page. And, you know, we read a study on a, I do a show called Able Against Top Ad. We read a study where 80% of people did not realize that their Facebook page was unique, right? They thought that everyone saw the same thing that they saw. They didn't realize the algorithm curated it for them. Mm-hmm. They didn't realize that they were being fed a bunch of lies. Because they thought everyone
had the same information.
Everyone had the same. So when they talk about, whatever it might be, Q, whatever it might be, yeah. They look at you. And if you disagree, they look at you like you have 8 freaking heads, like you're right. The moron, right?
Right.
So if someone commits an act of violence because of that, because they have this sole Facebook page, and let's just say that it says that there is a pizza restaurant that is harboring pedophiles, you right. go in and you commit an act
shoot like that guy did.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You go in and you actually commit a crime, you actually commit murder. Is that psychotic?
No.
Like, is there a defense for that? Because they believe so hard in one thing that is just not true, but that's not technically. You couldn't plea insanity for that.
No, you couldn't, because they're not mentally ill. They're misinformed, but it's your responsibility. Hey, but
is there a marriage between these two, though? Mentally ill and misinformed?
Well, mentally ill people may be misinformed because they have a delusion or hallucinations. Their mind is defective. Someone who just looks at their Facebook and thinks everybody gets his information and goes and shoots somebody, they are misinformed where they had the capability of educating themselves. They were in a, so you're responsible for, you have to be a responsible citizen. Anybody can do that. Then they acted impulsively.
Right.
So you being out of control of your anger, even though if your anger was fueled by media, doesn't give you an excuse to kill.
Yeah. We're seeing all the time people freaking out on planes and stuff like that. Let's just say, and you know, not, this is not for me. This is not a question that is only for me, but let's just say you're really hammered, right? And you commit a crime when you're just absolutely
not
lit.
For you, though,
right? No, not for me, right? Let's just say you happen to have a little bit too much and you freak the fuck out on an airplane, for example, and you're absolutely lit. Where does that fall in? Because your brain is not there. But of course, you got yourself hammered and you did act that way. I'm from Wisconsin. So there's many, many people wake up in Wisconsin with a hangover being like, wow, I'm sorry about what I said there. I ate too much pizza again. But is that a form of psychopathy that you can argue temporary insanity or anything like that?
It depends on the laws in the state. Like in California, you can. Being intoxicated is excluded from the insanity defense. But you could claim a diminished actual ability to control yourself. So it would be mitigating. It's not excusing. So you might be sentenced to a lighter. I mean, if you kill someone, you might be sentenced to a lighter sentence. So you might get, instead of getting 25 years to life, you may get 15 years to 25 but it's not, you can't use that as an excuse because someone who's psychotic is out of control of their symptoms. See, that's the thing you have to, it's a brain disease. You go out and you go to the bar in Wisconsin, you get yourself hammered, and then you go kill someone. You went and you got yourself hammered.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, you got hammered because you had such a great, you were a salesman and you had such a great money, right? So you go get hammered, kill someone. Is that why
selling catheters? You're like, the catheter, it was a great week for catheters.
See, so there's a difference. But at the same time, you're not as culpable as someone who's a premeditated murderer.
Right.
You know, you did it when you were drunk. So the law tries to be humane, but hold people accountable.
Yeah.
So it's the law is fascinating. People get very angry at it. But there is Oliver Wendell Holmes made this point. He said the law is the history of law is the history of experience, not logic. It's not logical. It's based on experience of human beings and accepting that human beings are fragile, but they have to be accountable. And so it tries to take these issues into account.
How do the jurors respond when you're on the witness stand? It reminds me a little bit of early 90s DNA, you know, going back to OJ, and jurors are like, I don't know about this DNA. I'm not sure. And that's pretty scientific. And now it's so well accepted as fact. It's laughable that anyone even doubted the science. But now, of course, in social sciences, it's a little bit different. You know, there isn't the helix thing or whatever. Do you have a hard time convincing jurors, or have you found, I don't even know if you can legally talk about that, but have you found that people are more accessible to the idea of mental illness now? Or just what are your thoughts on that?
It really depends. If I go in and I'm testifying in a case and there's a long history of mental illness and it's documented and the mental illness is involved in the crime, jurors are more accepting of that. They're less accepting, and sometimes I think wrongly so, but if there's no history of mental illness and somebody does a crime because they're got psychotically depressed, then it's a harder thing for jurors to buy. And it depends on the crime. I mean, jurors are very sympathetic to mothers who like postpartum depression, but at the same time, they could be very swayed by horrendous crime towards
absolutely
a child.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
And yeah, I can understand that. But at the same time, sometimes I think in cases I've worked with over the years, many times in cases they were, mothers were found insane, but sometimes they're not. And I think it's just the horribleness of the crime. And it's kind of like they can't get themselves to say, no, this person is not guilty by reason of insanity. Even though when you're not guilty by reason of insanity, you stay in a prison hospital or in a state hospital for years and years. And you look at Hinckley. I mean, he did this in 1982, I think, or 81. And he's just now being released. I mean, he's a man, really, now. So you, and in fact, sometimes defense lawyers make the decision, we're not sure we should, even though I think this is a case for insanity, we may be able to get a plea bargain where he would serve for maybe 15 years. If he's found not guilty by insanity, he'll be in longer.
Wow.
So they think maybe you should just plea bargain. If we can plea bargain, that might be a better way to go. And then we try to get him in a hospital and at the prison instead of sending him to a state house. So it's complicated. But the thing is that I think a takeaway is when someone's found insane, it's not a get out of jail free card.
Right.
It's very difficult. Only about 1% of the population, 1% of cases of all criminal cases are insanity cases, 1%.
Wow.
And most of those people found sane. Only about 40% of that 1% are found insane. So it's very hard. The standard, especially these days with the McNaughton standard, post-Reagan and post-Hinckley, it's the standard I gave you may sound easy, but it's very hard to meet legally.
Yeah.
Just say, because it's a cognitive. It's not that somebody loses control. That's an emotional. That's what's called volitional. So I just lost it. I got so angry. I killed him.
I snapped. Said,
no.
Yeah.
No. But you know what you're doing. You know it was wrong. It's a cognitive thing. You have to be. So it has to be like you have to be delusional. You have to be hallucinating. Yeah. I have to think you're a CIA agent who's going to come kill me.
Right.
It's not easy to be found insane.
Yeah. Any case, just kind of briefly, that sticks with you where it was just so horrific that you were like, oh my freaking Lord, why in the hell did I get into this business? Because I'm sure you've seen and heard it all. But you're still a human being. There's got to be something out there where it's just like, gosh darn, man, this sucks. Oh, yeah.
The cases that are like that for me are the ones that tend to be more with the psychopathic personality. Like I said, this man who killed his wife and then to cover it up, killed a family member, his little daughter, and then was kind of cool about it and still denied it. And even though the facts and the forensic facts, the hard evidence, my evaluation of him, it was clear this guy was guilty, but he was kind of smooth. Those are hard to digest. Like I tell you, with some of my psychotic people who killed and they were very ill, those what makes those hard to tolerate is the abject tragedy of it. Mm. You know, that these are a good person died, usually the caretaker of this guy. And afterwards, the patient is even mortified, or as much as they could be. Some of them are too sick, but they know they did something wrong. The whole thing is just so, so humanly tragic.
Yeah.
It's humbling to be part of.
Thank you for what you do, and you're saving lives. And this is, it's a fantastic, get the book, Decoding Madness, A Forensic Psychologist Explores the Criminal Mind, Richard Letary. Just lastly, when it comes to the true crime boom, we see, or I don't even know if you want to call it a boom, when it comes to people being more interested in true crime than previously before, what do you want them to remember when it comes to like watching the John Wayne Gacy documentary, or I think they make Ted Bundy look way too suave. The guy was he had sex with corpses, for crying out loud. But
yeah,
what do you want people to think about when digesting true crime information? Is there something that you, that upsets you about the national dialogue around it? I mean, for me, sometimes it seems like they honor the people too much, and that's my problem with the Ted Bundy docs
and
stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the case. But I think I did a blog on this too. I think people are interested in true crime for a variety of reasons. Like women, for example, particularly interested in serial killers, not because they have some kind of pathological interest in it, but I think because they're, it's sort of like they're looking for clues to feel safe, to look at what's, and I think people are actually trying to understand human nature of other people and themselves.
Yeah,
I think because people sometimes, when they have negative, these kind of horrific impulses, they think maybe there's something wrong with them. And I think they're trying, and they're not. Everybody has these kind of as dark thoughts.
Of course.
And this is, I write about this in the book, the demonic part of my interest in forensic psychology is my interest in human nature, because I'm also a psychoanalyst. And that's basically what I'm interested in, how people could be both, human beings can be so constructive. I mean, they can do great art, but yet be so destructive, they can create a place like Dachau. So the range of human nature is so great. And I think that's what people are interested in. And that's what drives an interest in this kind of true crime. It's not just some kind of nasty part of them that wants to sort of voyeuristic violence. I think it's deeper than that.
I agree. And if we have to understand human nature to hopefully change it for the better. Thank you so much for being here. Richard Letary, Decoding Madness, A Forensic Psychologist Explores the Criminal Mind. That was just fantastic. Thank you so much, man. That was great.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And thanks to everyone for listening. Richard, is there any other place people can find you if they want to reach out? And
anyone can find me. Just go to my webpage. It's crimepsychologist.com.
Oh, that's a great name.
They can leave me a message. There's my phone number there. And,
awesome.
And the book is available all over the internet, Amazon, at Barnes & Noble and bookstores.
Get it at a local bookstore if you can.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much
for listening. And it's there in the bookstores.
Hell yeah. Hail yourselves, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.